Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A new D-Day invasion of Europe? That's absurd, of course, but a D-Day may be coming for America to make concrete commitments to Europe in the crisis in Russia and Ukraine. The president has announced a billion-dollar plan to increase military deployments to Europe, but it's short of an increased permanent troop presence called for by some NATO countries. The president is trying to reassure U.S. allies on his way to the beaches at Normandy later this week to commemorate the 70-year anniversary of D-Day, and we'll talk about all of that in just a moment. Also, who exactly are those five Taliban officials released in the prisoner swap that freed that U.S. prisoner of war in Afghanistan? Why is there a police state mentality in a South Florida community? We'll look at an investigation into that. And the carbon regulation blues down in U.S. coal country. Also, later this hour, a rapper turns his health problems and traumatic experiences with drugs into a blessing for his hip-hop art. We'll hear some of your stories also on the healing power of art. But first, 25 years since the end of the Soviet grip on Eastern Europe is one of the symbolic reasons President Obama is traveling to Poland this week. But the Poland he arrives in is much cooler about its American ally than was the case a quarter century ago. Polish analysts quoted in advance of Obama's arrival in Warsaw said Poles are much more concerned about Europe these days than they are America. Poles are less likely to rely on American promises of support in the Ukraine crisis, for instance. But there were promises of hardline action against Russia at a news conference today. The president spoke along with the Polish president.
Mr. Putin has a choice to make. He can make a decision that, having now begun to pull back his troops directly on the border, he also exerts his influence to get these separatist elements to stand down. And if, in fact, we can see some responsible behavior by the Russians, then I think it is possible for us to try to rebuild some of the trust that's been shattered during this past year.
President Obama speaking today in Warsaw. But is there a subtle but growing divergence of interest between Poland and the United States behind all of this apparent consensus over the Ukraine crisis? Joining me now from Warsaw is Anne Applebaum, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Anne, welcome.
Thank you.
So there is a dance going on here. There's certainly a lot of unity about what's going on in Ukraine, but there is also apparently a cooling of affections between Poland and Eastern Europe and the United States right now.
I don't think it's so much a cooling of affections as a kind of natural readjustment. The Poles get many millions, tens of millions of euros every year now from Europe for development in the form of trade. And their relationship with the U.S. is a little bit more distant, kind of naturally and geographically. And the Poles are waiting for a more concrete commitment from the United States to the security of the region. And we'll gauge America's continued commitment really to Europe as a whole based on the kind of language that he uses here.
Would you say this readjustment that you're talking about means that the Poles and other nations here in Europe are basically looking for very, very concrete steps from the U.S., that the symbolic stuff doesn't really cut it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, the symbolic stuff we're used to, we've heard it before, it's all very nice, but I think people would really like to see a permanent base of U.S. troops in the region. It doesn't have to be Poland, it could be Estonia, it could be Romania, but just some indication that NATO, and particularly the North American piece of NATO, understands that the calculus of geopolitics in Europe has changed.
Is part of that calculus the fact that Europe, and particularly Poland, was very cooperative on sending troops to Afghanistan, and that really it's up to the United States to return the favor here?
Yeah, I think the U.S., the Poles contributed troops to Afghanistan. More importantly, they actually ran a sector of Iraq, although I don't think they got all that much credit for it. Other nations in the region also felt that they supported the U.S. several times in the last couple of decades. And they would like to know what that means. Is there a return for it? Does the United States still feel committed to the peace in Europe and to the idea of Europe whole and free, to the idea that Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, or at least from the Atlantic to the Polish border, to the border of NATO, is part of the United States security interests.
So this meeting is very much a tone of calling in favors on some level. I'm wondering if that makes it difficult for Barack Obama, and if the NATO charter is really going to be tested over the next several months.
I don't think calling in favors is the right term. And the main point of this meeting is Obama is coming to celebrate 25 years of political independence, again, not just in Poland, but across the entire region. There are many positive reasons why he's here. He's here to commemorate D-Day as well. He's going to Normandy after this. So I don't think there's a negative tone to the meeting. But yes, I do think now and over the next few months, people are expecting an American and a higher level European commitment to this region. We now have a different set of security issues in Europe. And I think Europeans, and particularly Central Europeans, would like to see the U.S. shift its policy to reflect that.
Anne Applebaum is foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Warsaw, Poland. Anne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now to that high-profile prisoner exchange that took place over the weekend. The five Taliban prisoners released in exchange for the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl from 5 years of captivity had virtually no prospect of freedom. As leaders of the Taliban, they were among the highest-value prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. But they are in Qatar now after President Obama used his executive authority for the prisoner swap over the weekend. We turn now once again to Carol Rosenberg, reporter from the Miami Herald. Carol's reported from Guantanamo Bay for more than a decade. Carol, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
Who were these five? And as I say, they didn't really have a prospect of freedom. They were certainly among the most difficult prisoners to imagine moving out of Guantanamo. But then, poof, they're gone.
On the one hand, you're right, because they were on the list of indefinite detainees, forever prisoners, as we call them, meaning in 2009, the Obama administration said, these are people who we can't try because we don't have any Guantanamo war court specific war crimes to charge them with. But we also can't let them go because we just think they're too dangerous to be let go. So they were indefinite detainees. That was their status on Saturday when they got on that plane and left. And so, in fact, you're right. You know, there are 149 detainees at Gitmo, and 78 of the men are cleared to go. They were on the list ahead of these five. But on the other hand, we have heard for years that the Obama administration was talking to the Taliban about trading them for Bo Bergdahl. So it shouldn't have been that surprising that they got it together. But who are they?
Yeah.
Three of those men arrived on day one. If you close your eyes and imagine that iconic photo of the men in orange jumpsuits on their knees in a cage, three of the men who left Saturday were in that photo. They were the so-called worst of the worst, brought in to open the prison camps. But time has taught us that the worst of the worst weren't. There's only eight of those men left of the first 20. Four of them are also cleared for release if there can be security arrangements, like the security arrangements that were made for these men going to Qatar. And you have to remember, they were brought in January 2002 at a completely different time in our detention strategy. These prisoners were thought to be in the first batch the kinds of people who might help the Americans find Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar. They were brought in as much for intelligence purposes as they were as, let's say, dangerous men. And the other thing that I think people don't know, because it really hasn't come out, is those men spent their years at Guantanamo in medium security confinement, living like POWs. Kind of like Hogan's Hero style, not you know, in a comedic way, but they weren't in single cell lockdown. They were cooperative captives. They lived communally in a doctrine that was set up for the people who weren't considered dangerous to the guards. They ate together, prayed together, did sports together. You could see them in the rec yards of the communal camps because they were profiled there as well-behaving they weren't even the hunger strikers. They were doing their time as POWs waiting for, frankly, this deal.
Well, I mean, how does that reconcile with the fact that until Saturday they were open-ended prisoners who were believed to be too dangerous to send away, but yet they were POWs not in a lockdown? Is there any evidence that they actually provided intelligence that helped in the search for Osama bin Laden? Did they have any value in the intelligence side of the equation here?
I haven't looked into the intelligence files, but there's no suggestion that they helped lead to bin Laden. And they certainly, there's no suggestion that they got the Mullah Omar, because I understand Mullah Omar is out there celebrating the releases of victory for the Taliban. Here's the thing. I think one thing that this episode really points out is we don't really understand what the Obama administration was doing in 2009 when they created indefinite detention. Indefinite detention was a category that kind of evolved out of the Bush administration saying we have the right to hold people as long as we want until we decide we want to let them go. Obama came in, left the impression he was either going to try people or let them go. They created a category of people they wanted to repatriate or resettle. And as it happened, all of those people that they created in that category were the same people that the Bush administration said, we want to resettle or repatriate. Then there was this catch-all category, and they were called indefinite detainees. One by one, they've been taking them off the indefinite detention list. Should these guys have been the first to go? No, they jumped the queue. They beat the people who were cleared for resettlement and release. But they're not going back to Afghanistan. They're going to some sort of a arrangement that our government tells us is going to be secure. Congress doesn't believe them. Congress doesn't trust them. I think we can see we're going to have a year's worth of hearings in which this is all going to play out while they sit in Qatar and do what they'll do.
But I'm wondering if some of those questions are legitimate. I mean, to say simply, never mind that these folks are actually not dangerous anymore, and send them to Qatar, which has a very public arrangement where they've supported the Muslim Brothers, the Islamists in Egypt. They definitely have an interest in Islamist movements in the region. What's to say they don't have sympathies with the Taliban as well?
I don't know that anyone has said they aren't dangerous. They aren't potentially going to be Taliban activists. They haven't renounced their membership in the Taliban. What I think I've heard is this was the price that this president was willing to pay to get this soldier out of there as he winds down a war in Afghanistan and will someday have to recognize that when the war is over, they may want to keep al-Qaeda, but they can't keep the Taliban. It's a distinction that, you know, some people at Guantanamo don't want to make, but certainly this administration has made.
Carol Rosenberg, reporter from the Miami Herald, on the prisoner release and the five Taliban prisoners who are now in Qatar, formerly too dangerous to release and now in Qatar. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
From the status of those Taliban prisoners to the released 28-year-old Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who's in a U.S. military hospital in Germany now where he's said to be in stable condition, the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center released a statement indicating that Bergdahl is being treated for dietary and nutrition needs. 5 years in captivity, though, there will be a readjustment. Psychological treatments are to be expected. Stephen Farrell is a reporter for The New York Times, knows what being held hostage by the Taliban can be like. He and his interpreter were kidnapped while visiting the site of a NATO airstrike in northern Afghanistan in 2009. Farrell was held for 4 days. British commandos staged his rescue. He joins me now in the studio. Stephen, welcome. Now, I suspect you are sensitive about any sense that what you went through is equal to the 5 years Bergdahl spent in captivity with the Taliban. But where do you think the intersections lie?
As you say, nobody, unless you've been through something like this, you can't really understand what it's like at all. And somebody like me who's been through it for a few days can't understand at all what it's like for 5 years. But this readjustment is putting it mildly. I mean, I think he's certainly going to face a very long path back to normality. He's going to, if my experience was any guide, he'll have been led across the tarmac of the base where he was led straight to a phone to talk to his family, straight into to see the doctors first, and then we'll have begun, and in his case it'll be a very long process, a very strictly regimented and carefully thought out series of procedures that are designed to bring him out of the world he was in and back into the new world of order and discipline, and you know, he's still a serving soldier.
And there will be a debriefing, attempts to determine what information he might have about what's going on the battlefield.
No question about that. I mean, I'm a civilian, and when I was after the doctors had finished with me, thankfully, very quickly in my case, I was sat in front of a table with a lot of people in different uniforms and different insignias, representing all sorts, I'm sure, of different agencies, asking me a lot of questions for many hours. Mm. And now, in his case, obviously, it's been many years, so that's not going to be an interview lasting a few hours. That's going to go on a long time. They're obviously going to want to know a lot about the opening minutes, how it happened, how he came to be in Taliban hands. But he's also, as I say, he's a serving American soldier. They're going to want to know, they're going to want intelligence from him. This is going to be many different aspects of this investigation.
You know, this is a sensitive subject. I mean, I don't know what your circumstances of capture are, but in many cases of people being taken hostage or taken prisoner, the circumstances of their capture can sometimes be ambiguous. I mean, in the sense of, a journalist making a terrible mistake, a too risky calculation, that once you're released, you suddenly carry a kind of guilt about, well, I'm sort of the cause of my problem, even though I was held hostage for a long time. In the case of Bergdahl, it's unclear what the precise circumstances are of his wandering away from the base, of him ending up in the Taliban captivity. All of that complicates this readjustment process. Can you address that a little bit?
It would be really foolish to speculate about what happened in those early. I'm sure many people have read accounts of fellow soldiers and so on and so forth with their opinions. I mean, I think we're going to be hearing a lot about this over the coming days and weeks. There will be investigations. The administration will be held to account, and there will be leaks and dribs and drabs and so on and so forth.
And all those opinions can be very painful.
Well, it'll be interesting to know if he's going to be listening to them, if he's going to be hearing them, if he's aware of them, what access he will have or will be granted or will demand to the outside world. I mean, they may decide that it's best to shield him from some of the negative opinions out there. He may demand to know. His family may give him a sense of what's out there, but protect him from the worst. I mean, all of these things are variables that we don't know how much he knows and will know. One thing's for sure, he can't spend the rest of his life in a bubble. At some point, whether it be weeks or months, he's going to have to come out, address it, and meet people. And I doubt people are going to be shy about expressing their opinions to his face.
In your case, you were released by a commando operation.
Yeah, I was.
And it wasn't entirely successful, that operation. Describe.
No. I mean, one British soldier was killed, and my Afghan colleague, a journalist, Sultan, was killed as well. It was a very bloody operation. Many Taliban were killed. It was a firefight in the middle of a village in northern Afghanistan. And I was very, very, very lucky. I know that. I knew that. I'll always know that.
Do you think that circumstance for you and others like it may have constrained attempts by the U.S. military to try to free Bergdahl using a military operation?
All these circumstances are different. It was a different part of the country. But
yep.
I'll give you an example.
Yep.
I was held for 4 days. On the third night, we heard helicopters come in, clearly to come and get us. They swooped into the village we were in. They went to the wrong house, or they went to a house for whatever reason. They went to a house some 100 meters away. We heard them come in over our house and go to the wrong. The Taliban immediately grabbed us and moved us to a school and literally lay us down on the floor surrounded by dozens of young children.
What was going through your mind?
And kept us there. Well, we obviously knew why they were doing it. They were doing it to create a human shield.
Yeah, you forget logic. Were you terrified?
I was constantly terrified throughout the experience. You're just aware. You become hyper alert and hyper aware to everything. You're judging every nuance. You're weighing all your own words. You're weighing every syllable. And I think that's an interesting state of mind to be in, because even when you come off the helicopter, your body is freed. You're talking to the doctor, you're being asked, are you okay in this respect? Your mind isn't. Your mind is still, to a certain extent, back in a house or back in a field. And I'm sure that'll be the case with him, that he'll be free, but he'll be looking backwards emotionally and intellectually to some extent. Your parts of your brain move at different speeds.
Freedom is a foreign experience.
It's a very new experience for him. I mean, for the first time, he's not going to have to be thinking, will every word I say get me killed? Will every new person I meet be the person who executes me? Will every new house I'm put into be under the charge of somebody who just loses it and empties a magazine into me? I mean, he will have been through all of that. Whatever the initial reasons for his disappearance, just looking at his tape, his videotape, let me go, let me go, let me go, repeatedly over and over again. I mean, he's clearly a very worried man trying to get out. That's what it looks like anyway.
Stephen, thanks so much for those insights. Stephen Farrell's a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, in the custody of the Taliban for 4 days back in 2009. Thanks so much. Carbon is a pollutant. This essential gas for the sustaining of life is also, in excess, a major cause of atmospheric warming. Human production of carbon is something the EPA wants to regulate, and the president has gone on the offensive this week using his regulatory powers.
Today, about 40% of America's carbon pollution comes from power plants. But right now, there are no national limits to the amount of carbon pollution that existing plants can pump into the air we breathe. None.
That's going to change. And yesterday we heard that the coal industry is already on the defensive, with communities looking at new technologies and natural gas to fuel power plants. Joining us today is Bob Vincenzo, the mayor of St. Clairsville, Ohio, home of the Murray Energy Corporation, the top employer of the city's 5,000 residents. Mayor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So coal is your only option at this point, right?
Well, you know, the city of St. Clairsville is a municipal power community. We purchase our power and then we redistribute it to our citizens. And with this said, coal is our main supplier for our electricity, although we are linked into some hydropower and also some solar power and wind power as part of our portfolio. But our main supply of coal comes from the use of coal. And it's very important that the coal is the natural part for us. It's very important that when this is brought to this stage of curbing, it's going to be detrimental to particularly our cities, but not only us, but our whole entire area. The onslaught of the coal industry is a principal employer, but more importantly, you know, it's economical for us in our area. And this carbon cut by 30%. It's going to be detrimental to our area.
Do you think this 30% reduction that was announced by the administration unfairly and disproportionately affects communities like St. Clairsville?
Definitely so. We have a lot of workers. But not only that, we had an aluminum plant which employed 1,200 people. They could not secure a favorable electric rate in order to operate that plant. The plant is closed. It closed last year. 1,200 people unemployed. And now they are dismantling that plant, selling the equipment. It's gone. Those jobs are gone. We'll never see them again.
Do you think it's the federal government's responsibility to clean up your coal plants, to basically finance whatever it would take to bring the emissions down, coal sequestration, those kinds of things that get talked about a lot?
I'm not quite sure saying that the federal government should do all this. What I'm saying is give us a break, and we could meet these standards, but give us a break. Don't cut us so severely. We've already reduced this emissions by 15% since 2005, and I think that's great. I think that's phenomenal that they've done that at this period of time, in that length of time. We could do the other 15%, but give us time to do that, and don't make these restrictions so rigid that we've reached deadlines that if we don't reach them, we shut our plants down. We've shut down three plants within our 50-mile area already, three producing plants, coal-fired plants. They no longer produce. anything. The stacks are empty. Yeah, they're not emitting anything, but they brought a lot of economic distress. Don't put a restriction on us to the point where we're handcuffed, that we either do it today or we're shut down.
What do you think of cap and trade, Mayor Vincenzo?
I thought that was probably the worst thing that ever happened.
So that's a dirty word to you.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You know, sometimes if we police within our own ranks, it's a lot easier sometimes than with restrictions, that some people are allowed to do something one way and we're not allowed to do it another way. And that's the principle behind all of that. And it ended up, you still had the same amount of stuff in the air.
All right, Mayor Vincenzo, good luck to you and thanks so much.
All right, thank you very much.
Bob Vincenzo is the mayor of St. Clairsville, Ohio, in the center of coal country. Beethoven's music is like a hilltop. Standing on his notes, you can look down and see the rolling hills and forests of Germany and France. Sometimes you can see all the way to the ocean.
Overcoming my trauma, art. I have gone into the mountains to draw landscapes. I have driven down the shore and looked out over the ocean and gathered my senses and drawn the water in the ships that I see sailing out there. These are the things I have used to alter my thoughts in order to move on, and believe me, it has worked.
Erin reached out to tell us how art was her companion at some very difficult times in her life.
Hello, this is Kathy from Charlotte, North Carolina. I turned to my favorite music to soothe me after my husband's death in March.
When I was diagnosed with cancer, I went home, got on my treadmill, and I listened to Rush for relief, inspiration, and hope.
And the men who hold high places must be the ones who start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart.
Austin, Texas shared this. Being a family of musicians with friends who are also musicians, we found listening to certain music helps with overcoming trauma and stress. We also find gathering together with friends to play and sing does this too. From Osterville, Massachusetts, comedy, doing stand-up, writing humor essays, telling jokes on Twitter, listening to comedy podcasts, all of it. It's a way to get out of your own head and see the absurdity of it all. It's cathartic.
I would always listen to the music of Tracy Chapman. She had some very interesting work, and whenever I was depressed, sad, angry, I would listen to her music.
I remember when we were driving in your car, speed so fast I felt like I was drunk, city lights day out before us, your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder, and I had a feeling that I belonged.
It's not all easy listening.
When he drove across the state line, rapper gone insane, story on Dateline.
Hip-hop artist Pharoah Monch's latest album is called PTSD, about his struggles with asthma and the medications that almost killed him.
Here's a guy who's normally quiet and reserved because of asthma, so to speak, so he doesn't move around a lot and he's pretty calm, or he doesn't take his mental medication in this particular instance, so he kind of loses it, and he says things on the song that he would normally say, and in this instance he's talking about the system and the industry because he's just fed up with it.
It's a tough issue, mental illness, in a tough hip-hop world where weakness is just not cool.
Especially in different communities, you talk about Black community, you even talk about hip-hop community. You know, it's a very brash and chest-poked-out community. Something invisible that's troubling you is difficult to bring up and discuss in the first place.
We'll talk with Pharoah Monch coming up next, but we're also hearing your stories. From Salem, Oregon, I Meditate, to down-tempo instrumentals from artists like Hiatus, Fortet, and Air, when life is busy and getting me down.
Hi, this is Jason from South Carolina. I just use art every day because it helps me to remember and forget my drug addiction, which led to an eventual prison term. It's usually cathartic and deeply personal.
This is Lara from Omaha, Nebraska. After I lost my son when I was 20 weeks pregnant, it was a very traumatic experience, obviously, and I turned to writing, and wrote all the time, very, very long passages about the stages of grief and the emotions I was experiencing. I turned that into a blog, and I actually have continued it today, 2 kids later.
Thanks to all of your stories. We'd love to hear how art was your companion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or share at facebook.com/thetakeaway. So how's it going, Mr. Shady?
My mom loved Valium and lots of drugs. That's why I am like I am, 'cause I'm like her.
Eminem made a career out of rapping his autobiography, his anger, his addictions, and his dreadful family problems. There is a tradition in hip-hop of music as a very direct memoir. In the case of Pharoah Monch, though, the self-referencing is not self-indulgence. It is tackling a profound public health issue in the African-American community, something he has struggled with, asthma, and the dangerous interactions of medications used to treat it, prescribed by a chaotic healthcare system. His 4th studio album, PTSD, tells stories that represent painful experiences for him, but they've also made Pharoah Monch a champion for people whose limitations and challenges have never made it into popular culture.
Asthma is something that's kind of a gift and a curse for me in my career. I went to art school at the High School of Art and Design here in Manhattan, and I knew very early on it wouldn't be a very physical thing that I could choose as a life career, you know, following in the footsteps of my pops. My family are all blue collar. My oldest brother is retired from NYPD and things of that nature. So having asthma as bad as I had it, those aspirations of in your childhood of being a fireman and all those things, that was out the window very early.
Family customs, we're not accustomed to dealing with mental health. It was more or less an issue for white families with wealth. Void.
So discovered this art talent and knew that was the way to go. But in art school, I was smacked in the face by the culture of hip-hop. And it challenged me to work my lungs to do these complicated runs and rhythms and flows. And so that's where I'm at.
In Bad MF, you really try to give a sense of how you're trying to keep your life together, but you can't juggle it all.
Rapper gone insane, story on Dateline. Lost his wits, didn't take his meds. When they pulled him over.
Yeah,
where's the place you're taking?
In that song, the spin I'm trying to put on the situation is, here's a guy who's normally quiet and reserved because of asthma, so to speak, so he doesn't move around a lot and he's pretty calm, or he doesn't take his mental medication in this particular instance, so he kind of loses it, and he says things on the song that he would normally say, and in this instance, he's talking about the system and the industry, because he's just fed up with it.
There was a point at which when you wrote down all of the prescriptions you were taking.
I'm talking epileptic episodes off that epinephrine, that albuterol and the mother prescribed medicines, a zombie and insomniac, feckety amphetamine.
Doctor or nurse took a look at that and said, holy moly, what are you taking? The interactions of all these drugs
right.
produce toxic, even psychotic reactions.
Right. Up until that point, you know, it would seem like something that you would be aware of, but their interaction and the side effects was so drastic that I never caught on because usually, you know, it wasn't my first time in the hospital like that. Usually I would come home and go back to playing basketball and stickball and two-hand touch with the guys and have some relief. But in this instance, I was just a dark cloud and didn't want to go out and couldn't sleep and couldn't put my finger on it, you know, not until I had went to the dentist. And this particular dentist needed the list of stuff that before they could proceed, he pointed out these side effects. And I mean, during that time, you know, when I was going through it, you know, I couldn't process anything that I would normally process. Like, just not sleeping will do that to you, but couple that with that cloud and that blanket, and it was something to deal with.
You know, when you have to finally admit that, you know, you've got a problem here, that in fact you're being treated for a diagnosed, you know, mental condition, what happens to the people around you? What do they think? What do they say?
It's part of the story as well, especially in different communities. You talk about Black community, you even talk about hip-hop community. You know, it's a very brash and chest-poked-out community. Something invisible that's troubling you is difficult to bring up and discuss in the first place.
When I drink away the pain, I guzzle. My life is like a complicated mathematical puzzle.
Again, you know, when this doctor figured out that this cocktail of medications was affecting me emotionally, I stopped and called my doctor and told him, and we redid the medication. And I mean, I've been out of that fog ever since. I can only imagine the soldiers, what they go through, and then trying to get reacclimated into a regular society, especially now with healthcare and what we're seeing with the veterans just recently in the news. You know, just likening that to my situation is one of the reasons I wanted to take the challenge and write this record.
Sympathy without equating the experience of being in battle.
Exactly.
Right, right. So on stage, I mean, there's such a universality to this experience of, you know, I mean, asthma is a big public health problem. And I'm just wondering if you get, like, solidarity from the audience. If you rap about asthma, do you have people whipping out their inhalers?
It's come to that, man. I mean, you know, I'm pulling out mine on stage just to hold it up.
There you go.
And I have a song with the incredible, talented Jill Scott called Still Standing off the last album, which we talk about passing out from, you know, chronic asthma. You know, we're still here. We're still doing music. So it's a very uplifting record. And whenever I do that record, I always take out the inhaler. You see a couple of people in the audience with theirs as well.
I love that. Well, you know, communities can come from anything. And common experience is what a community is about. Well, Farrell Monch, thanks so much.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Come on.
They say, please do not. Farrell Monch's newest album is called PTSD, Post Traumatic Stress Disorder. Up next.
People that we spoke to over and over and over again told us that they felt like they were under siege. They were living in a police state.
The residents in the community of Miami Gardens in Florida say they're living in that police state. We'll talk with two reporters who investigated the story. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Surely one of the most effective approaches to crime would have to be to simply arrest everyone in a community, take everybody off the street to eliminate crime, save the community by sacrificing it to a police state mentality. It sounds ludicrous, but it was basically on some level the approach in the South Florida community of Miami Gardens between 2008 and 2013. The police department there made more than 100,000 stops, questioning over 56,000 people, which is more than half the city's population. If that had been the approach of the notorious and now struck down stop and frisk program here in New York City, 4 million people would have been stopped and questioned. Miami Gardens resident Earl Sampson says he's been stopped 181 times and arrested 111 times. 71 of those arrests were for trespassing at the convenience store where he works.
I feel like I ain't got no rights. Like I ain't got no say-so. Every time they stop me, every time they take me down, they hurt me. I feel like I'm just a nobody. I couldn't go nowhere in my own hood without getting took down for trespassing.
I thought Miami Gardens, the police department, any police department, supposed to be coming for rescues, like, to help when you need help. But they don't come when you need help. They come when you don't need help and just come to harass you. They could just be walking like this, trying to go to your house in a rush, like looking down like, oh, I need to get home. Hey, why are you walking so fast? Stop right there. Don't move. Like, what?
That's Denzel Flowers, a 20-year-old Miami Gardens resident, stopped 27 times since he was 15, but never convicted of any crime. Alice Brennan and Dan Lieberman led the Fusion Network's investigation into Miami Gardens Police Department. They join us now. Welcome, guys.
Hello there.
Hi there, John.
How did you get started in this investigation, and why do you think this is happening?
Well, it started back in the fall with that guy, Earl Sampson, who we just heard from, who was stopped hundreds of times by police. And that was published in the Miami Herald. And, you know, we wondered back then kind of what was going on in this community. How could one guy be stopped hundreds of times? And if it was happening to one person, we wondered what was going on in this community.
And then we ordered the police records from the Miami Gardens Police Department, and over 100,000 records landed on our desk. It took us another couple of months to go through them and clean up all the data and do some analysis, and then we found some incredible things.
And what you found translated into some pictures of what's going on in the community. What did the camera capture that really shows what's going on in Miami Gardens?
An incredible snapshot. 99,980 stops in a population of 110,000. 8,000 kids stopped over a five-year period, and thousands of senior citizens also stopped. So what we basically found was an invasive and very aggressive, what has now been called stop and frisk strategy.
Yeah, and the public defender down here calls this, New York stop and frisk on steroids.
And the orders were coming from the top down here, right?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like this really started back in 2008, 2007, with under a zero tolerance policy. And under that, the police were given sort of free rein to kind of go out and stop people on the basis of trespassing and loitering. A lot of it was recorded on these field contact forms.
We spoke to two whistleblower officers from within the Miami Gardens Police Department, and they told us that they were given orders from the top to stop any black male between the ages of 15 and 30.
My major walked in and verbally told us that the target to stop in Miami Gardens, he wants all black males stopped between the ages of 15 and 30 years old.
And did you think this was wrong?
Absolutely. You need reasonable suspicion or probable cause.
Now, you're disguising their voices and their faces there. They're very concerned about their jobs.
Yeah, because, you have to understand this. The police chief there, the police department, basically said, these are the orders. And if you followed them, these officers said you were promoted. You were given special assignment. If you didn't, well, you suffer the consequences.
But what do you make of the argument that Miami Gardens has a real problem with crime? It's a high crime neighborhood. Sure, it's next to Miami, which has a very different approach to policing. But this is definitely a problem area that requires maybe unique and innovative solutions, so to speak.
It's an incredibly high crime area. They in a small city, they have 25 murders a year. The thing is this policy's been in place since 2008, and the murder rate hasn't gone down. It's stayed the same. So obviously something is not working with this approach. We spoke to the City of Miami Police Department, and in a city of 400,000, they only made 3,753 stops. Their approach there is very different. Now, the City of Miami has large pockets of its population with similar demographics to that of Miami Garden. So, I mean, the approach is very, very different.
And interestingly, these police officers said this was actually the worst type of policy to have in a high crime area because you have a terrible relationship with the community.
Does that explain the turnover at the top there in Miami Gardens, PD?
In the last 6-7 months, there have been 3 different police chiefs. I mean, the community is trying to react to this, but we still don't know what's going to happen. I mean, and when you hear from the people like Denzel Flowers, he's 20 years old now, but he says he was just afraid to leave his house. And he said it was like making a deal with the devil living in this community. He said, if you grow up in a high crime area like this in Miami Gardens, you're going to have a record. And if you don't have a record, the police make sure you get one.
John, the other incredible thing that we found was there are some people who are super angry and upset and motivated, and then there's a large proportion of the population there who have grown up with this policy and they've normalized to it.
Can the new leadership at the top change things? Here's Stephen Johnson, who's the chief of Miami Gardens Police Department, number three in less than 6 months here.
As of my start date, there are no quotas in the city of Miami Gardens Police Department.
Any confidence that the Johnson administration can do anything here?
He actually admitted that it was the wrong tool for the job. The question now is where to? What accountability is there for those who instituted this policy and continued this policy?
Meanwhile, what is the social consequence of this having been normalized, of people growing up with an expectation they're going to get stopped multiple times, that a criminal record is basically a part of being a citizen in Miami Gardens? That will have consequences over the next few decades, yes?
Definitely. I mean, there are 8,000 children in Miami Gardens now who have their name on a public record. It's a publicly searchable database. And most of them are recorded as suspicious people. On the contrary, the police chief, Stephen Johnson, says, you know, it's just your name in a database. It doesn't mean that you're a criminal. But public defenders are saying, you know, it's against the Constitution to, at the age of 10 and 11, be recorded as a suspicious person.
Dan Lieberman is investigative correspondent for the Fusion Network, along with Alice Brennan, also an investigative producer for Fusion. They did this investigation into the policing approach, a very aggressive stop and frisk program in the community of Miami Gardens between 2008 and 2013. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. From Gitmo to Bergdahl, Carbon Blues, Art as a Healer, and Aggressive Policing in South Florida. Go to thetakeaway.org and share the conversation on all these subjects with your fellow Takeaway listeners. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.